The last time I talked in this church, I cried like a baby. I'm not going to do that today. Although my baby might cry a little bit. So as Dwight said, yesterday was the World Day against the Death Penalty. It also marked the end of an 83-mile walk from Lucasville to Columbus from a group organized by a group down in Portsmouth, Fellowship of Reconciliation. It also involved Ohioans to stop executions, murder victims' families for reconciliation, and the UU justice group in Ohio. And also yesterday, there was a gathering in Cleveland of exonerees, of death row exonerees. And you should know, if you take away anything from today, there are currently 155 death row exonerees. We added one last week. And in Ohio, we have 9 death row exonerees. And I had the good fortune of taking one of them, Derek Jameson, to a Cincinnati Reds game about a month ago. And Derek is a big Cincinnati Reds fan and had not been to a game since he'd been released. And so I got to take him with a friend of mine. So 155. And 9, right? Those are 2 numbers to walk away with. I'm going to speak today about the death penalty, about executions, in part through my book, The 13th Turn, A History of the Noose, which was inspired by something that happened 9 years ago. In the fall of 2006, several black students at a high school in Gina, Louisiana, asked an assistant principal if they could sit beneath a tree that they believed was traditionally reserved only for white students. They did. And the next day, 2 nooses were found hanging from that tree. Racial tensions in the community came to a head, and there were fights in and out of school. And one fight on school grounds resulted in 6 black students being charged with attempted murder. The charges sparked a national outcry, leading to likely the largest civil rights demonstration since the 1960s. When asked by school officials investigating the noose incident that sparked it all, the noose tiers claimed that they didn't realize that black students would find the nooses offensive. They said that, honestly, they didn't know that history. And in some ways, I believe them, because I grew up in Orangeburg, South Carolina, and I knew nothing of the history of lynching in my hometown. And I realized this while writing my last book, Blood and Bone, which explores the killings of 3 black men in Orangeburg in 1968. While writing that book, I learned about several lynchings that happened there. And I realized how ignorant I was of this history, as well as the sheer number of people who were killed during America's lynching epidemic of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And just to pause, we're talking about, based on the Equal Justice Initiative's recent research on this, we're talking about 4,000 people over the span of about 40 years who were executed in the southern states alone. In the entire nation, about 4,800 people. I decided that when I finished Blood and Bone, I wanted to learn more. And I believe it's important to account for this history, a history that most people, especially white people like the young Jack Shuler, don't want to or don't have to face. So I wrote this book in order to learn. The 13th Turn is a sketch of the life, a biography of sorts, of an object whose meaning goes far beyond its look and feel. That biography is a story, I believe, about how we come to understand the things that make us wince. In some cases, I travel far from home and into the wilds, so to speak, of the human experience. That journey is important because it puts us in the place of the violent act and reminds us that these things happened in specific places, in our communities, in our backyards, in our ancestral homes. The noose has served as weapon, spectacle, ritual, artifact, relic, symbol of ultimate state justice, and as a way of defining victims as inferiors. The book examines these issues from the Iron Age to contemporary Iran, And throughout, I remain loyal to the questions that stirred me to write the book. Why is the hangman's not being used to intimidate Americans of many races and backgrounds in the 21st century? Why has the noose become a symbol of intimidation, surpassing the burning cross, a tool for radical racists at a moment when some pundits insist that we live in a post-racial America? Why does this thing have so much potency? To truly understand the American story, these are answers that we need. And I assumed as I began writing The 13th Turn that it would be a book about lynching, in part because it was going to be a book about the noose in America. But what I didn't realize was how it would transform my thinking about the death penalty. I was surprised by all of the ways that lynching and capital punishment intersect in the way America executes mostly the poor and racial and ethnic minorities. The top three jobs of the over 15,000 people who've been executed in American history are slave, laborer, and farmhand. And over half of those 15,000 people were black. In the way that we dehumanize condemned people, in the way that executions are never a deterrent, in the way that executions are applied arbitrarily, in the way that executions rarely provide closure for victims' families, and I think too, in the way that both lynching and the death penalty, through it, we completely abandon human dignity. We cease to see each other, and we lose sight of what it means to be human. If this is the case, then the work to reconcile ourselves with the past and the fight to abolish the death penalty as a visible sign of inhumanity should be central to the progressive project of promoting human dignity. And the more I learned, and the more I looked, the more I realized that this had to be a central part of my own justice seeking. But when I talk about the book with friends or strangers, I've noticed the body language that follows. Arms cover the body, heads tilt, winces ensue. When a neighbor asked me about my latest project, he winced and said, "Oh God, really? Just say the word execution or lynching aloud in a crowd or at a party," which I do have to sometimes. "Heads will turn away or towards you. Either way, it's the same message. Oh God, really? Please don't go there." At a cafe in Copenhagen where I was teaching 2 years ago, a man came up to me and asked me what I was writing about. "Do you really want to know?" I answered. "Yes," he replied. So I told him. "Oh my," he said, "you need to focus on light, on the positive. Jesus would want you to focus on the positive." I looked up at him, raising the eyebrow. And I said, "Yeah, but don't you think that Jesus would be against the death penalty?" What is it then? Why are we afraid to talk about this? Why are we afraid to look? And regarding the pain of others, Susan Sontag addressed the controversy over an exhibit of lynching photographs and postcards called Without Sanctuary. The exhibit traveled around the country beginning in 2000. Sontag writes, "Some people, it was said, might dispute the need for this grisly photographic display, lest it cater to voyeuristic appetites and perpetuate images of black victimization or simply numb the mind. Nevertheless, it was agreed, there is an obligation to examine. The more clinical examine is substituted for look at the pictures. It was further argued that submitting to the ordeal should help us understand such atrocities, not as the acts of barbarians, but as the reflection of a belief system, racism, that by defining one people as less human than another legitimates torture and murder. But maybe they were barbarians," she writes. "Maybe this is what barbarians look like. They look like everyone else. And of course, we are everybody else." What do I mean by that? When people are killed by the state or by the mob, we are complicit. either by our action or the soft complicity of our inaction. When we refuse to look at these people as people, we are complicit. When people are executed in Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas, Missouri, Arizona, Georgia, and even in far-off places like Iran, we are complicit. As I wrote this book, I kept coming back to the obvious. The violence of modern punishment is concomitant, and its concomitant culture of retribution have old roots, and we haven't strayed too far from those roots. While there may have been a shift from regularized public torture, tell that to the people being tortured right now in police cells, in prisons, in detention centers, and execution chambers in the West, the modern West. And tell that to all the people watching violence on television and on the silver screen. And also, perhaps, watching execution videos online. There are dozens, if not hundreds, readily available. In 1908, the U.S. Postmaster General banned mailing lynching postcards, but the World Wide Web doesn't function in the same way. There's much to see if you wish to look. Iran still uses the noose, and often in a very public manner. Hangings are publicized events. Some are televised, and many are recorded and available on YouTube. The UN Special Rapporteur to Iran reports that at least 53 of the 753 executions in 2014 were public. In 2013, there were 687 executions, and 56 were held in public. In Iran, murder, rape, drug trafficking, sodomy, adultery, and apostasy, among other things, can lead to the death penalty. Iran executes more juvenile offenders than any other country and sets the bar at puberty, age 15 for boys and 9 for girls. Khadi Ghami, the executive director of the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, told me that hanging has become an important mechanism of social and political control for the Islamic Republic. He's working diligently to change that. In the 1980s, Ghami points out, most executions were of a political nature, but now public executions are often for so-called moral issues. According to their own admission, the majority of executions are for drug-related crimes, and more often than not, those killed are poor local dealers who can't buy their way out of the judicial system. Iranian officials, Ghami says, believe that they can use capital punishment to fight the drug problem, but there's been no indication that it's worked. The drug problem continues to grow. In a sense, he says, this is a war on poor people, ethnic minorities. These people are being targeted and sacrificed. It sounds all too familiar. But the increase in public hangings, Ghami says, is most disconcerting. He said, I'm troubled by the psychological impact of the hangings on the viewer, particularly children. It desensitizes the public through violence, preparing them for further acts of political and official violence, and making violence as a formal element of public policy. And they're happening more often now, he believes, than in the pre-revolution era. Ghami has paid close attention to where the hangings are happening, when they're happening, and who's attending them. His eyes are wide open. He's looking. It's this last trend that he focuses on, how so many young men are attending out of curiosity, how it fosters a lynching-like atmosphere, how hanging people has become publicly has become normalized. I asked him about the many videos of Iranian executions that are on YouTube, and I asked him who they're for. Ghami says that they are posted as government propaganda to spread the idea that they are willing and capable of extreme violence. The videos serve as a warning to the broader public that any kind of dissent or challenge will lead to the noose, and international pressure will not deter. And yet, he says, They can and have produced the opposite effect. Gummy is a physics professor. He used to teach where I taught at Brooklyn College. And now he's a human rights activist. When I first spoke to him, I asked him if he saw a relationship between his physics roots and his current work, and he laughed. I suggested that maybe it has something to do with the universal relationship of objects. Exactly, he exclaims. An object subjected to an external force will no longer stay at rest. Perhaps these videos are an external force, and maybe we should see them as documenting atrocities and holding a regime accountable in the public sphere. Images can raise awareness, the argument goes. The Marion lynching photo that inspired the song Strange Fruit. The body of Emmett Till shown in an open rather than a closed casket. Or the photos of Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, the video of Walter Scott. Maybe the hanging videos can teach us to respond to the noose in a certain way. Or maybe it can come from learning about the work of the death penalty in our own backyard, paying attention to prisoners, to those on death row. We teach each other to kill, as we teach each other to tie knots. We can also teach each other to not kill. And in the same way that the knot is a technology that develops over time, so is our revulsion to this knot, and hopefully to state-sanctioned murder. To the impending murders right here in Ohio of Ronald Phillips, Raymond Tibbetts, Alval Campbell, Gregory Lott, Angelo Fears, and the 18 other people Ohio plans to kill through 2018. Ultimately, though, the hanged, the executed, cannot speak of their own experience, and thus our comprehension of the act comes up against the limits of representation. It is, to borrow from John Conroy, an unspeakable act. Unspeakable because the deceased can't describe what they've experienced. Unspeakable because violence, any kind of violence, happens when we abandon speech, when we abandon language. Unspeakable because it is an act which I, the writer, cannot even adequately describe. In the early 1920s, a Danish explorer and anthropologist named Knud Rasmussen recorded the songs and stories of Inuit people living throughout the Arctic. In a Netsilik community up near Hudson Bay, he recorded the song of a shaman named Orpingalik, and it goes in part, "Songs are thoughts sung out with the breath when people are moved by great forces and ordinary speech no longer suffices." Those are some of the most beautiful words that I've ever encountered. Words that connect me with Orpingalik because I can empathize. I know what he's talking about. You know what he's talking about. The beautiful and sometimes sad things that make us sing. But a human being hanged can no longer sing, of course. And it's song, it's art that make us human. We desire to tell our stories to those who come after us, to leave something like a memory in a poem, a drawing, or a tale. In these things, we find our true human selves, the perfections and flaws, the exceptional moments and the mundane affairs. This assemblage, this history of action and inaction, is a record for posterity. It's what we leave behind. Our history is recalled, as any archaeologist or museum curator will tell you, in the objects we use, touch, and carry. A coffee mug, a hammer, a steering wheel. This is the kind of history that I was after while writing this book. The history of an object and the human hands that formed it. It's a violent history, and one that we should look at carefully. So I believe that this wincing comes from somewhere, perhaps from genuine revulsion, but maybe also from the belief that lynching is a thing of the past and that the death penalty is something beyond our control, that these are big forces at work and that we can't change things in our lifetime, so best not to look. But despite the morbid nature of the noose, despite all this death, I've learned that there is life here, much life, beautiful life, and I see this life in the fearless activism of someone like Hadi Gami. I see this life in the courageous actions of people who've taught me to look closely, to not wince, to keep questioning, to say something, to sing something, to write something. Thank you.